Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This episode is with Des Trainer, founder of Intercom. We get deep into the weeds of company building, advice to entrepreneurs, finding product market fit, hiring, firing, productivity, and a lot more. Des is one of the best growth and product-oriented founders in the game, and if you are building a company, you will definitely learn something. All right, here's Des. Coming from Dublin, what's that been like, kind of adjusting to startup culture, to the Silicon Valley world? What's that process been like?
It's definitely different. It's San Francisco specifically is a city where things move incredibly fast, and you know there are no obstacles, there is only progress, and that's really, really refreshing. From a sort of startup and tech perspective versus, I guess, cities that just aren't startup hubs. Like, I don't think there's anything uniquely Dublin that makes Dublin the way it is. I just think you have, in my head, it's just there is San Francisco and there are places that are not San Francisco that want to be. And I think, honestly, the divide is like that. And for me, it's not a Dublin thing per se, basically, but the way I see it is SF is where you need to be. It's where you'll get a lot of energy. It's where you'll find your suitably high tempo for how things need to progress, and that, like, you know, that's the adjustment for me. It's mostly one of moving from a city where things move at their own speed to things where everything is enabled to move as fast as it needs to.
Yeah, I went to Dublin for Web Summit this past year, and man, it was raining all the time. People were drinking at like 4:30 p.m.
Yeah, well, Web Summit is like a lot of conferences. It's a party masqueraded as a convention, masqueraded as a conference. I wouldn't say that's probably not a typical experience either. Yeah, we definitely have rain, but you know, that's part of the parcel of being located where we are.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back on your story a bit. You know, you've been doing Intercom for 4 years, but before that you were at a few different startups. How did you get into tech to begin with?
I guess I've always tinkered with computers. I started off with an Amiga 500 when I was like 7 or 8 years old, and I remember working in BASIC, I think AMOS was another tool I used, and we used to build sort of fun games. I used to buy computer magazines where they'd give you the source code printed out, and you'd transcribe it into the machine and watch how you could play Pong and things like that.
What do you think you'd be doing when you were a kid? What do you think you would do when you grew up?
I think I was probably divided between something to do with, like, science, creating, inventing. I mean, some of my favorite films were things like Batteries Not Included and Weird Science and stuff like that, where where basically the key point was somebody made something that was pretty cool. So I think I was always drawn to like creating things. As I kind of maybe hit like 12, 13, 14, it became very clear to me that computers is where I seemed to be able to. It was mostly like, you know, when in the absence of actually much of a programming thing, and you have to cast your mind back to like 92, 93 when the net wasn't around either, the only inkling I had that I was good at computers is that I could fix other people's computers. You know, when shit went wrong for them, I could usually work it out, or I guess I could work out how a machine was behaving and predict what sort of change would help it go back to the way we wanted it to behave. So that was kind of, once I realized and kind of, you know, had like continued success at that, I then made the choice when I was, I guess, 14, 15 to study computer science when I went to college, which was 18. When I walked into first year computer science, and I think maybe 3 weeks in, I was like, I absolutely love every single thing I'm doing here. Like, there's not a single thing that bores me. Other people are annoyed, other people are pissed off. I actually think everything we're doing is awesome. And that was when I realized like that I'd, you know, finally found a thing. Now, I wouldn't say finally. I wasn't a moody child. I enjoyed a lot of things like maths and economics and stuff. But computer science and programming were definitely the things that like I kind of felt the most reward and joy from.
And most people never find that, especially not at such a young age.
I think that's definitely true, and it's sad, but it is, and there's something unique about, for some reason, programming, a lot of my friends do it, obviously, it clicks with people in a way that I don't see other jobs click, like, and I don't mean this to disparage other jobs, but a lot of folks I know end up in careers in kind of, you know, like, say, business consulting or whatever, like, where they basically don't, like, they see it as a job and it's something they do to collect the paycheck, but they never get that extra zest or sort of like a lust for life that I think a rewarding job can bring.
who did you admire people like Bill Gates? I mean, who were kind of your role models in this field?
I always liked Bill Gates, but I liked him because I can occasionally be like, I like to be a contrarian of sorts. So whenever people like to mock Bill Gates, I'd always point to the achievements. And even today when people talk about, like, you know, Microsoft or whatever, I'd always sort of be the one to point out, well, you know, has been more progress on malaria in the last 5 years because of Microsoft and because of Bill Gates than there has been for the previous, you know, hundreds. I think Bill Gates is definitely a role model for me, both at Microsoft and post-Microsoft. Other people, I mean, I don't know, I always liked sort of classic scientists. I read everything that, say, Stephen Hawking's produced, Einstein, Paglia. I read, like, you know, like they weren't so much idols as they were people like whose work, who like obviously predate me massively, but like whose work and workings had a long-standing influence on how I think and act.
You strike me as like a really precocious, like a kid who was ahead of his time. Did you were the other kids in the class, you know, were they also into this stuff? Did you feel that you fit in? Did you feel like very different?
Yeah, I guess I probably hit it a little bit. I was just kind of a regular kid in most regards. I think it was only really when I got to university that I found people who were like my people who were smarter than I was and had knew more than I did and could teach me things. And that was when I kind of found a clique that I would hang around with. And I learned a whole heap of things. I learned everything from how to write Perl to how to run my own Linux install to how to build my own Linux distribution to how to write a web app. All that sort of stuff was all things I picked up in spare time by hanging around with people who knew how to do these things.
And this is when you founded Bigulo?
Bigulo, yeah.
Bigulo. Talk a little bit about that story and what you learned along the way.
Sure. So I was working with, like, when I was attempting a PhD, I sat beside a guy I'd been in class with called Andrew Page. And basically what happened was there was a very popular social network in Ireland called Bebo. And Bebo was kind of popular elsewhere, but it was hugely popular in Ireland, New Zealand, UK, and Australia. And that was really, for some reason, where its impact started and stopped. And Bebo was mostly, honestly, quite poorly built, and it had no search engine, which meant that the whole idea of, like, oh, I'll friend you on Facebook or whatever, that idea never was popular. It's actually probably one of the biggest limits they had as a product. And Andrew at the time was working on like massively scalable, parallelizable systems for a human genome mapping or something like that. But anyway, as a byproduct of this, he was really good at writing algorithms that could parse massive data sets, farm them for the information we want. And so he started producing this algorithm. And he was like, hey, look, I can tell who your friends, and I can tell all the people you've got in common with all these other people. And I was like, oh, shit, that's interesting. And he built a plain text mapper against that. And I was like, all right, this is definitely something that can be productized, or we can make this something useful. So I worked on the front end of it, and we gave it a name and we gave it a logo. And we started promoting internally, and we promoted it on a few Irish sites. And then it kind of just took off. Then we started doing a few other like things. We, you know, did like most viewed pages or most popular pages or whatever. And we made it like a tool that you could do things like, you know, show me everyone who's age 30 in New Zealand. And it would work for those sort of things. And one of the fun effects was somebody found their like long lost sibling. I think it was their brother.
Wow.
Just through this system, which was kind of cool. We were like really impressed. And Bigelow, like, it worked up until a point. I think what happened was we were... Like, the way I always think of when you're building on somebody else's platform is like you're picking up pennies on a railroad, and there's a big train coming down. So you can definitely pick up a few pennies, but that train's going to hit you at some point unless you get off. So in our case, Bebo itself tanked. They sold for $165 million to AOL, I think. And they basically just went into a period of rapid decline as Facebook became the dominant social network. And as a result, we were, you know, it basically lost all its value, lost all its traffic, and that was the end of our first stab at a startup.
And what are you thinking at this? Are you just devastated at this time?
No, we hadn't really put our whole life into it. Honestly, it's one of those things when I look back that, like, if there was, say, an investment ecosystem in Dublin, or if the web was a little bit more mature, or if me and Andrew happened to have been in Stanford or San Francisco or somewhere like that, I think it could have been bigger. I think ultimately the idea still would have fallen to pieces because Bebo itself was going to be defeated by Facebook. I think that was pretty much inevitable. But I do, you know, I think we never really had the opportunity to put all of our effort into it properly because, you know, it was like I wouldn't have even known what that meant. It wasn't like we definitely put a lot of hours into it, but we learned so much like that. It wasn't so much devastation. One, because there was no one tipping point. It was kind of a gradual decline over like probably the course of a year, and certainly for that year we weren't doing much on it. It was just keeping itself going. So yeah, it wasn't a massive impact. I don't think on either of us personally. As I said, we learned a whole heap from it though.
Got you. So it's 2010, you know, this thing you've been working on for 4 years, winding down. How old are you at this point?
I'm not sure if it is 2010, but in 2010, I would have been 29. I'm just not sure if that's the exact right year. Yeah.
Got you. So you're almost 30. What happens next?
So a few things that happened in parallel. In 2007, I dropped out of my PhD because I basically found myself 3.5 years deep into something that I didn't really want to do. And I decided to go and do something I did want to do, which was create software. And the best way I knew to create software at the time was to design software. I was certainly capable of programming, but I felt like I was more uniquely useful as a designer than I was as a developer. So I joined a design consultancy here in Dublin. Worked there for a year, and then I met Owen, who is the CEO of Intercom, and Owen asked me to join him in the creation of a new consultancy called Contrast, which I did. And Contrast basically was what I worked on with Owen and the other guys for, I think, I'm not perfectly good at maths, but let's say 3 years. That kind of led us up to 2011, which is when we embarked on the Intercom journey.
And how did the idea for Intercom come about?
We had a product before Intercom called Exceptional. And with Exceptional, we had thousands of people who used and depended on the product, but we had no idea who they were or what they were doing. And whenever we wanted to communicate with them, it was incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. So typically to talk to our paying customers meant going to PayPal, pulling down a CSV export of all of our paying subscribers, and then importing that CSV export into an email marketing tool like Campaign Monitor, and then deciding to filter out certain people who we'd already spoken to that month, and then sending out an email and then waiting. And it was so arduous a process that it was just not worth doing most of the time. So the idea of doing something simple and lightweight, like say, hey, why don't we ask our paying customers what they think of our new reports feature? That just idea would not present itself to you because it was just such a hard thing to do. It was like at least an hour's worth of hardware type work, like as in just overhead of creating lists and filtering and finding and sorting and saving. And similarly, like another thing we used to do was like interview customers for our blog back then, and even finding out who had recently signed up was painful. So we had all these thousands of people using the product, and we had no way to see them or to talk to them or engage them in any way, shape, or form. Another thing we had to do frequently was send them a message to tell them about any upcoming changes in the product or to apologize for downtime or whatever. And not only was that painful, but when you're apologizing for a fault with your product, you don't want to mail every single user because only a small number of them were ever affected. So Owen had the idea of like, well, why don't we just talk to them inside the product? So when they log back in again, we can tell them, but like, there's no point in mailing the entire user base about this. Now, if you think about this, what it sounds like is, well, segmenting users based on what they do or haven't done and talking to them in a place where the context matters most. All of these ideas, seeing your users, understanding what they're doing and talking to them based on what they do or haven't done, is all the sort of underpinnings of Intercom, which is why we created Intercom.
It's been 4 years and Intercom, has been growing tremendously. But if you can go back to, 2011 when you're just starting, what are some of the things you'd tell yourself?
I don't know. That's a really hard one. I think like product wise, I'd advise us to pay more attention to certain parts. For example, we found out, I guess, the hard way that dealing with rich text editing is tricky, and that realization probably cost us quite a chunk of development work. other product-wise stuff, and some stuff we definitely probably would have done sooner, some stuff we would have done not at all. But like, I think, you know, honestly, if I was to tell you like, oh, we definitely wouldn't have built this, I'd be sitting here today wondering, oh, I think that's a great idea, we should still try it. You know, it's really, really hard. It's easy like to post-rationalize sort of all these product smarts, but like the reality is some mistakes just have to be made to take them off the table as something we could consider doing. So we've been pretty good at killing features from our product along the way when they haven't gained traction, and we'll continue to do that. But I would rather, you know, there's no version of events where you just don't do it and never think about it, because I think that would just mean you're not being a smart product person. You're not having interesting ideas. So given the two choices of having never done it and continue to think it's a good idea, versus having done it, knowing it doesn't work and canned it, I'd rather have it tried it, basically. It's better to regret the features you did than to be sitting here mourning the things you have yet to do.
Right. And is it is the process you guys use to come up with Intercom what you'd recommend to others looking for startup ideas? You know, identify problems, or should they focus on things they really care about? Or what would you give advice there?
So I'd say both of those things mattered greatly to us. We identified a problem we had, and it was a problem we really cared about. I mean, there are other problems like that you have as a small consultancy, but we just didn't care about them. We could have, you know, gone and revolutionized payroll processing or something like that, but that didn't really resonate with any of us. I think definitely the way I think about it is like, it's infinitely easier to solve a problem you intimately know than it is to spend massive amounts of time constantly researching something because you're not the end user. I think when it's such a force multiplier to actually understand the problem. Whenever I talk to young founders, what I really think about a lot is like, how well do you understand the problem that you're solving? And that's usually the best measure you have of like how likely they are to succeed. Now, obviously there's executional challenges, hiring challenges, all that sort of stuff. But like at the very, very outset, when I meet somebody like, oh, I'm going to build time tracking, I'm like, okay, why would you build time tracking? They're like, oh, well, you know, I've got this Rails app and it can track time. And I'm like, okay, cool. But just to be clear, is time tracking a problem you've ever encountered in your life? Well, no, but my dad runs a business and he says he needs to track time. And I'm like, right, this is probably not your problem. Like, you know, like I know there are people who will claim that through use of extensive personas, extensive research, et cetera, you can compensate for a lot of this. And I would agree, you can't compensate for it, but you can't match it. It's not to say that's impossible, but it's just, I certainly don't know how to solve other people's problems. And like I used to do user research for a living, and I still think it's like outrageously hard.
What's some other advice you find yourself giving to young founders?
Things I hate to see from early stage companies. I hate people who are insanely distracted by multiple ideas. At some sense, this becomes a really abstract, vague point about saying be focused. But what I really mean is like, somebody comes to you like, and they have like too many fingers and too many pies. I'm just like, right, you're probably not going to make any of these count. So I think, find something you deeply care about that you have a long-term care for, like, not, you know, find a problem you will always care about, find a problem you directly experience yourself, find and work with people before you form a company with them. So don't like do these founder dating things where like you're like, oh, let's I'm gonna go look for a technical co-founder who's going to build my whatever billing app, like, you know. And then it's just the most, I feel like it's such a flawed foundation for a company that two people meet and they agree on some sort of equity split, and then like having never worked together, off they go into their first, you know, venture together. It's like it's as serious, and honestly it's weirdly like, you know, more serious than something like marriage, because it's in a lot of ways there's so much more stress than there is, say, committing happily to somebody you love. So like, I think find somebody and work with them and get to know them before you get into any sort of discussions about forming a company or any of that. Kill all your side projects and work like hell. I think lately hard work seems to have gotten a bit of a bad rap in our industry, which is kind of a weird one. But like, for some reason, people are like sort of, you know, promoting these ideas. They're like, you know, oh, you can do this all with only 4 hours a week or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, cool. You probably can't. You know, you're not that smart. You're probably really smart, but, you know, let's assume there's at least one other person in the world who's as smart as you. If they're going to work harder than you, they're going to win. I'm not saying like that it's, you know, hard work overall. I do accept that you need to stay charged. You need to like stay enthused. You need to feel great about yourself to actually commit. But you do need to commit too. You need to actually work your ass off too.
Right. When you see, you know, people who are just graduating college and ultimately want to build a big company, should they start right away if they have the idea and a partner, or should they spend a couple years maybe at Facebook or Uber or smaller like Intercom, or what's your advice there?
It's a good question. I only know my route, so I feel like I'm not fully equipped to prescribe it to other people. I guess the concerns I'd have is, they'd want to have worked with the people they're going to start a company with. And maybe that's okay if that's, you know, college projects or whatever. But they want to have worked with them and been tested. Like the relationship between the founders has to be incredibly strong. The other piece I'd say is, I think more than wanting to be an entrepreneur or than wanting to start a big company, you have to actually want to solve the problem, because you can be an entrepreneur. You can incorporate, you fill in some documents, you pay a couple of grand to a solicitor or a lawyer or barrister, and you're done. So now you've been an entrepreneur, and if that was your sole motivation, that's not really that, like, you know, that's not a massive achievement. And like, I wonder, will you have enough energy left in the pool to actually keep going back through the grind? Secondly, if you want to build a big company, well, what happens when you have a big company? Do you then consider yourself done? What drove Microsoft to their success was like a computer on every home and on every desk and in every home. Like, you have to, like, and they had a hell-bent notion for that. Or like to connect the world is a big, big mission. Or like to like index all of the world's information. Like, you have to have that sort of guttural desire to complete a mission, not just to achieve some sort of like external visual artifact of success, like a job title or like a company size or a headcount or a fundraise.
Yeah. And what inspired, you know, you recently came out with a couple books. What inspired the books? Did you always think you would write a book?
I thought it was probable that it would happen at some point. I think the way these books happened was much more, people are asking for this, we should really get ahead and do it, than it was like, you know, go off into the forest and meditate about what the world could learn or whatever. So I think that was one part of it. I think a book was probable because of the amount of writing we had done. So what inspired us to do it was a large part of people asking us for it. Like, they're like, hey, you guys have like hundreds of posts and all this stuff. Can you put it all together? And you know, sure we can. I think we all learned pretty quickly that there's a big difference between merging a load of blog posts into a shitty PDF and calling it a book versus actually trying to do something that has high production quality, which is what we wanted to do. I think we probably underestimated the task in our first pass. To produce a proper book, to have it available in multiple formats so it can be read on a Kindle, on a phone, on a desktop, etc. That's like, you know, it was definitely a significant undertaking, and we learned a lot. The second one was certainly a smoother process because of it. The inspiration really came from like people really think it's a great idea, and then us trying to work out, is it like, you know, can we make it a justifiable business activity?
You know, what's really impressive about Intercom, and I've interacted with probably about a dozen people, maybe more, from Intercom and the various kind of ways we work together, is that everybody is from, you know, whatever position, is really passionate and really on the ball. Like, I'm just impressed with everybody I interact with. How have you hired for that, or how have you built that into the team culture, that everyone is just super passionate about what you guys are doing?
It's very much one of our values. Like, we have a set of values that we keep internally about like what we actually want to achieve as a company and how we work and what we value in people. And, you know, curiosity, passion, drive are all things we look for. As recently as like yesterday, I was in a meeting, we were talking about hiring for more engineers, and like these values keep coming up. Like, the people who get along best, the people who have most impact, the people are people who care the most, and people who, you know, they don't see it as a job. They see it as an opportunity to really put a dent in the world. And like, that's, you know, cliched as hell to say, but like, some people are happy to like, you know, have a job and collect the check, and that's totally fine. But we're really like, you know, one of the things we really, really value is passion, drive, you know, curiosity, people who are consistently and continuously seeking ways to improve themselves, people who are delighted when you give them feedback because they're like, holy shit, that's awesome. You mean I can be better? Amazing. It's, you know, it's something you have to value. It's not so, like it, you know, you have to be inflexible about the things you really, really care about because frankly, it doesn't work any other way. So yeah, it's just something we've consistently looked for.
And how have you, this is something we think about, how have you kept that as you've scaled? You know, right now we're 18 people, but you know, we're hiring, we're growing. How have you guys, you know, continue to keep that or thought about what happens as you scale?
You know, I think as you scale, what happens is if you take you guys a product hunt, what happens is like you'll have like many waves of the company. And so like maybe you're like, I don't know, 15, 20 people now. I have no idea, I'm guessing. But like what will happen is you're going to add new business units. And those business units that you add will have themselves founders, people who are growing your sales team or growing your marketing team or your finance team or your analytics team or whatever. And you can expect whatever people you put into those roles will basically multiply by 10. If you have one person who's super crazy, super passionate, and they run all of your analytics, you can assume that they will grow a team in their exact likeness, strengths and weaknesses. And I think the way you scale it is you make sure that anyone who's going to grow a team is just make sure that you are fully bought into them, what they stand for, what they value. So as you start adding these business units, or as you start, say, splitting up these units into like, you know, into different components, just make sure that like the people who are ultimately in charge of growing those teams have the exact same value code that you do.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Do you still look at every hire?
Me, no.
Yeah. Do you have a head recruiter who takes care of that, or?
The team leaders grow their own teams, and like this, I think what I'd advise other companies to do is pay a lot of attention to who's growing the team because they need to be kick ass and very much aligned with the company. And then after that, a serious level of trust has to take over if you actually want to scale.
You've talked about hiring being, you know, one of the most important, you know, elements of a team. Do you have quick hiring advice when, you know, or when you like evaluate someone for the interview? What are key things you look for to determine whether this is someone you want on your team?
I don't know if they're that unique, but like certainly it's something I'm very interested in is people who are actually passionate about their discipline. So if you are going to work on a certain area, I personally am very biased towards people who actually care a lot about it. So by care a lot, maybe it means they write about it, or they think about it, or they research it, or they go to events about it, or their friends work in the area, but something that kind of connects the dots that says it's not just an area that they phone in on. That's something I really want to see, which is just an extra degree of passion, curiosity, etc. Other stuff is like, if you know, will the people who have to work directly with this person get along with this person? Are they definitely like-minded? Could you imagine... if they were sitting around a dinner table and you had to sit between with this person on one of your sides, would that be a good or a bad thing? Like all the sort of classic cultural fit things are all very, very real. The other thing is like other things I look for is like, will anything be added to the company? Like, are we getting anything actually new here? Is it more of the same? That's not necessarily a problem, but it's certainly a positive if someone that can bring a new perspective, a new value, and a new skill set. That's also really, really useful. But like, I think the biggest things are like, the hardest part about hiring for me is that you're under kind of like, if you're doing things right, you're basically under eternal pressure to be hiring. And you're also, you know, that pressure creates a temptation to you know, justify a decision based on an exception or like an edge case, as in, I know he can't do blah, but he can blah. And, you know, as soon as you start doing that, you'll never admit it and you'll never say it out loud, but you're starting to slip on what you value. You're starting to slip on your culture. And I think that's the biggest thing I think you have to be resilient against is the temptation to adjust things to try to solve your own scaling challenge.
Yeah. Now, what are some of the biggest challenges you guys are currently facing?
Hiring is probably, Yeah, I mean, that's probably, like, I mean, if you're talking about what's number one on my mind, that's definitely like, it's something I think I think about a lot, and I'm, you know, I'm working hard on.
No, it's refreshing, you know, in that it's refreshing to see you guys just kind of be very humble and, you know, focusing on hard work in kind of a climate where startups are really glorified and founders are becoming celebrity, but Intercom's not about that as much. How have you guys how have you kept your team humble throughout all this?
I think, I don't know if humility is the right word so much as like a sense of perspective. Like Intercom isn't like one person or four people or whatever. It's like 120 people or 117 people or something like that, you know, and like, certainly, like when if there's a huge new release that goes out, and all of a sudden, like we recently released an awesome mobile integration for Android and iOS, and you know, it's very, very hard for me to do anything other than point to the people who are successful in doing it. So I think, like, I think I understand that, like, from an external or from an outsider's perspective, people like to have kind of a more simplistic view of a company. That it's kind of complicated to be like, oh well, you know, it turns out there was a team of seven people involved in the shipping of this and the design of this and the execution of this and the support of this. They just want to hear, you know, that's tied to whoever. But like, I think, like, as long as you can keep a strong sense of internal perspective and know how awesome the people you're working with are, it kind of, you know, I don't feel particularly great in Intercom because I look around and I see so many people greater than me. So like, that's where, if it is humility, that's where it comes from. But like, you know, I think for me, humility is the wrong word. It's more about perspective. I do agree with you that I think it's easy for startups to kind of become overly impressed with themselves, and you do see like celebrity founders who are just kind of constantly want to be like, you know, like listed and quoted on TechCrunch or whatever. And like, their startups are usually, you know, like it's quite clear that they're more interested in being known as a person than they are in solving the problem that they set up a company to do.
Yeah. And who are some of the people you most admire in tech, whether it's as a, you know, as a CEO or as a product person or just for personal characteristics?
People I admire in tech. So like, going back a bit, like, I was very, very influenced by the writing of Joel Spolsky, who's the CEO of Stack Exchange. I think he's CEO anyway. Also Fog Creek, also Trello. Joel was one of the best writers on software. Unfortunately, he stopped blogging around about 2008, 2009 or something. But he was awesome. And I definitely, like, you know, a lot of how I work and how I think was informed by a lot of his ideas in the early ages. Paul Graham, back when he used to blog prolifically, was definitely somebody who had a large influence on, again, how I think about things, how I think through things. I still find myself, even these days, quoting things that he wrote about in like 2006. Then I guess, like, on the design side of things, there's a handful of people who continue to amaze me with their ideas. Brett Victor, who's like, he's at WorryDream on Twitter, former Apple designer. As far as I know, he's kind of quite vague about this, but I believe he designed like the core of iOS. But that's not even the most impressive thing he's done. Like, he's just shockingly phenomenal. If anyone's looking him up, they'll see a lot of talks by him. His talks are probably some of the most mind-expanding things I've ever seen. Wilson Miner was a fantastic speaker on design. I was lucky to see live in Belfast a talk he gave called Why We Build. That was, again, one of those moments that I think, like, every second of that moment, I feel like I have a HD memory of it. It was so impactful on me. That was recent enough. That was maybe 2011, 2012. What are people, I mean, like, obviously I have lots of peers and friends in the industry who I'm always amazed by what they achieve and how they achieve it. But, you know, they're too numerous to list that I'm almost scared if I list some of them and forget others, I'll disappoint somebody.
What's been, you know, now that you bring that talks up, what's been the biggest way that you've educated yourself? Are you a big reader? Do you watch a lot of talks or listen to podcasts? How do you learn?
Probably almost exclusively through reading. I listen to podcasts whenever I drive, but I don't, like, I'm not, like, great at listening to them. I can only listen to stuff when I'm in my car. Like, if I'm at home, I'll end up doing something else. So reading is the only thing I find that is quite relaxing and I can really engage with properly. I'd say I like, I read things ranging from blogs by people who I trust to like HBR, the magazine. I'm a passionate and happy subscriber. I read books on business topics, like Clay Christensen would be one of my favorite authors. I, you know, and then like any area that comes up that's new to me, whether it's like branding or marketing or sales or business strategy or anything like that, I'm like, I basically look for a pretty well-written book on the topic. I say well-written rather than great because some of the famous tomes of business are like, you know, 700 pages, and I know I'm not going to get through it. So I'd rather read all of a good book well written because I know I'll actually get through it than read like two chapters of something that everyone's saying is a must read, but like it's actually reads like junk. So that's a small bias of mine. It doesn't mean I go for like pop literature. It's just I like books that are designed to be read. One example of like that would be a great example of that would be Jason Fried and DHH's books, Rework, Remote, Getting Real. They're like, in my opinion, like, they're very, they're created to be read. There is no filler. There is no fluff, like almost to a fault in that sometimes like a little bit of filler actually helps your brain straighten thoughts out as you're moving through the book. But they're very, very sharp, and I really, really value that.
Yeah. What do you have any productivity secrets or hacks for yourself that are just principles that you swear by that you recommend to others?
They're not mine, but I certainly use them. I mean, I definitely follow Inbox Zero as best as I can. I'm, you know, like, I think basically email is one of those things that I don't like people who say they're not good at email. I just think, like, that's not a useful... That's like saying I'm not good at correspondence. It's not a smart thing to say. So to that end, like, I do, you know, take my inbox pretty seriously. People will get replies if they mail me and they... and a merits one. I do use like all the usual stuff like keyboard shortcuts, etc., for managing that. I have a sort of personal principle I try to follow a lot, which is if something can be done, if something's in my mind and I can do it in 5 minutes or less, I'll just go ahead and do it straight away. Because I try to keep myself focused on like bigger things, but like it annoys me if I'm like, oh, I have to tell such and such about so and so. In those things, I just find it's easiest to get it off your plate as soon as possible. So always do little things instantly unless it interrupts a big thing. I'm a big believer in long periods of focus. So in general, like I know if I want to do something, like write an article or review a draft or something or whatever, I'll tend to leave my phone behind, take off my watch now, I guess, close my laptop and go somewhere where I can work literally uninterrupted and not even see what time it is, because none of that's relevant to what I'm actually trying to do, and leave myself no distraction to get it done. Other things I've always sort of, if there's something hard and kind of daunting, I think you're better off, like, one thing I've learned over time is like problems don't age well. If something's a problem today, it's going to be a bigger problem tomorrow. Best case scenario, it's the exact same size problem, but you've postponed it longer, which means that, you know, you're not doing your job particularly well. Problems don't age well. I read a thing today, and it was phrased as the worst should come first. I think that's a kind of fun way to say it, but basically, like, when you have something that needs fixing or needs changing or needs adjustment, you're like almost always better served by doing it as quick as possible. And that can be anything from fixing parts of the product or re-communicating something that you made a screw up or like, you know, getting around to sending that email that you've been putting off because it's annoying you or whatever.
No, definitely. How do you define the success for yourself?
For me, it's, you know, not to be meta, but it will be like achieving all the things that I want to achieve. And then how does that map to what are the things I want to achieve? Well, one of them is I really want to solve this intercom problem. I really want businesses to be able to communicate and understand their customers in a better way. I really want to like create a world where in like years to come, you know, if you're at home and your laptop breaks or your microphone breaks or your Xbox or your television breaks, that you simply go to like the Samsung website and they say, "Hey, Eric," and you say, "Hey, guys, my television broke." And they're like, "Oh, is that the 42-inch that you bought 3 months ago?" And you say, "That's the one." And they say, "Okay, well, here's exactly how you can fix it, or let us know and we'll send in a replacement." And if you compare that experience with the experience as it is today, where it's probably going to involve fucking fax machines and phone calls and call centers, I really want that world to exist. That is, for me, like the one of the biggest personal desires of Intercom, is to like make sure that businesses and customers know, understand, and can easily communicate with each other. Then, like personally, obviously, I want to personally be happy. I want to, like, you know, I want to look back on a life. I love the, I think it's Alfred Lord Tennyson's his quote, which was It's Raymond Carver who wrote from his deathbed. His last poem was, it's called Late Fragment. And the quote is, "Did you get what you wanted from this life, even so?" And his response was, "I did." And then it was like, "What was it that you wanted?" And he said, to have myself beloved upon the earth and to know myself beloved upon the earth, which I think is a nice way to think about it. It's to know that you mattered and to know that people cared that you mattered. And I think that's like, you know, when I think about life at the highest level, like that's the biggest thing for me, is like, you know, like whatever. That's kind of why I can't get excited about solving problems I don't care about, for example. Because, you know, when I look back, I actually want to know. And like, I know people say like, "You're 34, it's a bit early to be talking like that." But like, you know, the thing is, these are the years where you actually do the shit that matters. So for me, what matters is to do the things I want and to have mattered.
And let's just say, in an ideal world, you know, you absolutely 100% achieve your dream with Intercom, whether it's in a few years or whatever. Intercom is everything you want it to be. It becomes that. What do you think you might do next? What's left to achieve?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've kind of like forbidden myself from thinking about any of these type of what do you do after type things, because it's just, you know, after it's kind of, at best, it's a novel distraction or whatever. And like, there are loads of other problems I see and I experience. But I'd have to sort of see how I felt, you know, how I felt post-Intercom. If you're to phrase that slightly differently and say, like, what are the problems you wish people would solve? Well, that's different. I'm a huge soccer fan. And basically, technology or software and soccer have practically ignored each other for the last 20 years. And that really annoys me, because it means that no matter where I am in the world, there is no easy way on earth whatsoever to find out how to watch a game. I can illegally stream it, which makes me a criminal, or I can basically go to a hotel room and find out that it's not showing on any channel. But there is no like Spotify for soccer. There is no easy way. And I, by the way, I've been saying, giving variations of this answer for 3 years in the hopes that somebody will fucking try and do it. But like, that's like, you know, it's one kind of recurring problem for me. I wish somebody would adapt. You know, what we see is like, look at how the music industry has transformed in the last 15 years with the advent of like the internet, and look at how soccer stayed the exact same. That's a problem that, like, if I met somebody who was working on, I'd be like, "That's awesome. I, you know, go get them." I wouldn't be able to help because I have my own thing to do. But like, yeah, it's definitely something I could be excited about solving.
Yeah, maybe you could invest. Have you started investing, or do you have an interest in investing?
Nah, you know, I think my attitude towards all that is that it's not a like, you know, the one way I'd be comfortable doing it is doing it from a sort of fire and forget perspective, like, as in, like, you know, not a million miles, unlike an educated bet on a hand of blackjack or something like that. But I think, like, you know, to actually make investment work as a anything other than a random speculation, I think it would have to become more of a distraction. And I don't, like, as we said earlier, I don't really agree in anything that can distract you from what it is you're trying to achieve in this world.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. The tech ecosystem as it currently exists, are you really excited about it? Are there things that you wish would change on a broader level? And it's a very broad question, but feel free to take it, whatever it means to you.
So in the tech ecosystem, I mean, I don't really know. Like, there's loads of like junky moments in software still to this day. And like, you have people like Apple who are amazing at hardware, but, you know, not great at software. And you've got people like Google who are the exact opposite. And you've like, you know, neither of those two understand how people connect. That's what Facebook do. Neither of those seem to understand like real time. That's what Twitter is kind of best at. Like I wouldn't advocate for like merging any of these, but I do know that like that the reason most junkie experiences happen, for example, is because most companies have only really become world class in one particular trajectory. But I think that's just the fundamental nature of things. Other stuff I think about, I don't know, I don't really have, like, I try to be optimistic about the world in general. I find, like, the people who are, like just perpetually negative never seem to really achieve much. So I don't really want to, like, I'd hate to be, like, down on things. Like, there is definitely, like, I love the idea of spreading the internet to be, like, worldwide, truly. And I love the initiatives that Facebook and Google have taken. And that I think it's absolutely awesome, so commendable. I'm an optimist. I'm bullish on software, if you like. And that a lot of people say, oh, it's not the solution to everything. I'm like, yeah, I think maybe that's true, but let's try it for everything because we're not trying anything else. So I don't know. Like, I could talk to you about all the problems I see as they play out, but I think it would only depress me and make for a kind of shitty interview, you know.
Especially as a way to close.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Yeah.
Des, I appreciate you taking the time. I know that we're big users and fans of Intercom, and the Product Hunt community is big fans as well, and also a big fan of you and your writing. And so we're glad to feature it. I know you got a lot of work to do. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. And thank you for all you've done for Product Hunt.
No problem at all, Eric. Thanks so much.